The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
Putin is saying things like, don't you dare send anything in. In the meantime, he's killing thousands and thousands of people. So he's acting like we're an aggressor. If we send in some old 44-year-old plane, and thousands of people are being killed. And when he says, don't you dare do that, and we all say, oh, he said don't do it, we don't want to start. The fact is that what he's doing is a human tragedy. There's not been anything like this, certainly since World War II, when you look at it. You can't let this tragedy continue. You can't let these thousands of people die. It's going to be hundreds of thousands and maybe millions of people by the time it ends. But he's a different person than he was. He seems to be different. It just doesn't seem to be the same person I was dealing with.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, good afternoon. It is good to be with you today. I'm Drew Mariani. Thanks for joining me. That, of course, was former President Donald Trump. He was on, I believe, Fox Business on Monday, and he commented on his perspective on Russian President Vladimir Putin. And it has seemingly changed since the two men were dealing with one another during the Trump administration. And look, people change, right? They do. You probably know that in your own life. It happens with change, with age. It happens with pressure. It happens for all sorts of reasons. And for Donald Trump to come out, he said, look, he seems to be different than the person I had routine contact with as president. And he says, I'll tell you something. There's just something different about him. And he raised this question. And I would be careful about it, you know. Because I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist. At one point, the host, and I believe it was Stuart Varney, he asked about Putin. He said, is he sane? Is he solid mentally? And again, Donald Trump, you know, shifted without offering too many specifics. He says he just doesn't seem the same person that I was dealing with. He says, we had a decent relationship. It was hard because of this whole Russian thing, you know, but he just seems different. I've been praying for Vladimir Putin. I hope you have been too, right? We're called to pray for those who persecute us. We're called to pray for our enemies. Clearly, what we're seeing unfold in Ukraine is horrific. It is devastating. I was watching video of the destruction of Mariupol. Vladimir Putin, of course, could take that city over and more than likely will. But what's he left with? 80% of the buildings in Mariupol have been turned to rubble. They've been turned to rubble. We are witnessing the largest human exodus in modern history. We've never seen anything like this. And the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, he came out and he discussed, his openness now to discuss a commitment, from Ukraine not to, become a member of NATO. So, Vladimir Putin's going to win on that front. That's really what he wanted. Did they have to go to war and destroy the city over that? Should Zelensky have just said, okay, we won't become? I sit back and I look at this story, and I don't want to dive too deeply into it. We'll break it down at some point in the future, look a little bit more on what's happening in Ukraine when it comes to nuclear weapons, because they gave up their weapons in 94. And I'm sitting back and I'm thinking, if I was that nation and I was Zelensky, I would think, why did we ever do that? Vladimir Putin would have been very hesitant to do what he's doing today if he thought that there would be retaliation. The problem with this mindset, though, is that leads to a proliferation of nuclear weaponry. Because everyone's going to say, well, my neighbor has it, I want it. Otherwise, they're going to roll over on me. Might makes right. And that's not the case. The U.S. gave assurances, hey, we'd have your back. And of course, there's been lots of reports about our javelins and our stingers and the destruction it's doing. There's been a report that 10,000 Russian soldiers have already lost their lives. And that's a tragedy. Pray for them, too. They don't want this war. A lot of protests, a lot of arrest in Russia, and this is just the beginning. But I have huge news to share with you on this particular point. I got word literally 10 minutes before walking into my studio here that the prayer for the consecration of Russia has been released by the Vatican. What I'm going to do for you after we prayed the chapel today is I'm going to walk you through that prayer. We're going to break it down. We're going to talk about what's happened. I'll give you a little history behind the four other consecrations that have taken place, why we need this one. And what does it say about the 84 one? There's a lot to get into. I'll be joined by a very noted Mariologist, and we'll look at all that for you. So I invite you to join me today. That's 3:30 Central, 4:30 Eastern. Yeah, so please consider doing that, 1:30 Pacific time. We'll read the prayer, or at least we'll go through it for you and let you know. But I think things will change after that's done. Now, I'm not expecting on March the 26th for things to radically be different. It took months and years for the Iron Curtain to collapse and the Soviet Union to disintegrate. But there's going to be change. You mark my word. There will be change. Good is always going to triumph over evil, and we will get through this. As I said, the president, you know, he's willing for an exchange for a ceasefire, any withdrawal of Russian troops to go ahead and to vow that they won't become members of NATO. It's a compromise for everyone, he says, for the West, which doesn't know what to do with us with regard to NATO, for Ukraine, which just wants security guarantees, and for Russia, which doesn't want any further NATO expansion. Is it the answer? I think Ukraine ends up losing in the mix. That's kind of unfortunate. But we'll see what happens. In fact, I don't know if you know this, but the Ukrainian President Zelensky actually shared that he had a conversation with Pope Francis. And he said to the Pope, I didn't know this. I just discovered this today. He welcomed him as a mediator in the war with Russia. Look, he just wants mediation. He wants to meet with Vladimir Putin. He wants to be in dialogue with him, and he wants to find a peaceful corridor for this. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin is being relentless, even during the conversations, and I may have shared this with you yesterday. He's not ceasing the fire. He's continuing to drop rockets from the sky because he doesn't want Ukrainian forces to regroup. Zelensky told the Holy Father about the very difficult humanitarian situation and the fact that Russia is blocking these rescue corridors. You know, they're trying to get citizens out of there. And there are people with no water. There are people with no clean water, let alone heat or electricity. So the mediating role of the Holy See in ending the human suffering, Zelensky said, would be deeply appreciated. He sent it out in a tweet. And he also thanked the Holy Father for the prayers for Ukraine. And as I said, this Friday, the Holy Father at noon Eastern, 11 Central Time, will consecrate, and I looked at the prayer, he'll entrust, that's the word he uses, and the big deal here was, with some experts I've spoken to, will he use the word consecrate? Will he consecrate Russia and Ukraine? That's key in this prayer. Well, as I read through the prayer, he did indeed use the word consecrate. So, yeah, I tell you, graces are going to flow. I'm excited. I'll be here along with Father Rocky at that time. We will give you analysis. We'll give you insight. And we'll give you coverage. We'll go live to the consecration prayer. So I invite you to join us for that, okay? And pray with us that day. Be part of what is, I think, a spiritually historic moment. And also join me in about maybe 50 minutes or so when we continue our novena of chaplets praying for peace. And that's what we're doing. We'll do that coming up in just a moment. The president is warning Americans, of course, to be prepared for retaliation from Russia. He has warned today that Russia is exploring the possibility of waging a potential cyber attack against the United States in retaliation for what we've done, all those economic penalties. And he's telling America and many of its businesses, brace for the future. Here's what he said.
Today, my administration has issued new warnings that based on evolving intelligence, Russia may be planning a cyber attack against us. As I said, the magnitude of Russia's cyber capacity is fairly consequential, and it's coming. The federal government is doing its part to get ready. But under U.S. law, as you all remember, the private sector, all of you, largely decides the protections that is you will or will not take in order to protect your sources. But let me be absolutely clear about something. It's not just in your interest that are at stake when there is potential use of cybersecurity. It is the national interest at stake. And I would respectfully suggest it's a patriotic obligation for you to invest as much as you can in making sure, and we will help in any way, that you have built up your technological capacity to deal with cyber attacks. First, to protect your own companies. Second, that provides critical, as providers of critical services that Americans rely on, from power to clean water. And finally, your role you can play in helping secure every American and every American's privacy.
So that's the president. I would suggest you say a prayer for him as well, and say a prayer for our own country. I said to my wife, you know, I really don't have reserves in the house. You know, I don't have cash out. I haven't done any things that I talk about here. You know, Maggie and I talked about it. She's like, I got to get cash out of the bank. I'm like, you know, you should have some cash on you in case power goes out, banking system gets hacked. I mean, you should just have it, right? I've yet to do that. Maggie's probably a little better than me. And then, of course, you know, you need the extra water. You need, I think, at least 2 weeks of food to get by. You know, it doesn't have to be a whole lot of things. Some pasta, some canned goods, tuna fish, whatever, peanut butter, I don't know. Whatever you like. Maggie was seeing the same fire starters. See, when you go down the path of prepping, and we should revisit that again, I mean, where do you draw the line? There's so much stuff that you actually really do need. Again, this will be a short-term thing, but it can be crippling, you know? And just, I listened to the president. We have yet seen anything. They were expecting February 24th, the day that Russia rolled into Ukraine, to see these attacks. And of course, we haven't. We've yet to see it. I'm sure our defenses are on the lookout, but I hope businesses look back up. Use double encryption, do all the things they tell you to do, and be safe. I want to bring one more story to your attention, if I could, for just a second, okay? And this is a story that just, well, it surprised me. You know, we talked about Rachel Levine, right? We talked about her the other day. She was given the Woman of the Year Award, or was nominated by USA Today for that. Rachel Levine is actually a... well, it's actually a man, right? You know that. And, I don't know if you follow the Babylon Bee or not. It's a satirical website. You know, they put out headlines that look very legitimate, but they're really just fake stories that are written up for entertainment. And they did a story on Rachel Levine. They've gotten locked out of Twitter. They're in Twitter jail, I guess, over a tweet because they renamed Rachel Levine Man of the Year. Come on. I mean, that's funny. This is what they do, right? This is what they do. So the CEO, a guy named Seth Dillon, wrote, he says, I just received this note that we've been locked out of our account for, quote, hateful conduct, right? Hateful conduct. It's called satire. It's humor. Outlawed? Is humor outlawed? Here's what the CEO said in an interview earlier today about this rising censorship that we're experiencing today.
We just got locked out. We got notified that we were locked out last night. We get an email that says that we violated the rules for hateful conduct. And they cited a specific article of ours. We were doing a satirical take on the USA Today recently naming Rachel Levine, a transgender individual, as one of their picks for Women of the Year. So we did the satirical take on this, and we named Rachel Levine as our pick for Man of the Year. And Twitter didn't like that very much. So we ran afoul of their hateful conduct policy, and they basically notified us. They said, look, you know, your account's not suspended. You just need to unlock it, and you can unlock it by deleting that tweet. And we're like, well, wait a minute. Deleting that tweet requires that we agree that we have violated the hateful conduct policy, and we don't agree with that. We don't believe that speaking the truth is hate speech. And, you know, satire does often speak the truth. It does it in a humorous or ironic way. But, you know, we stand by the point that we were making in that article. So we're kind of at an impasse here where we can't get our account unlocked because we're not willing to delete that tweet.
You know, it's a little silly being charitable, being, in what I'm saying. It's ridiculous is really what it is. This is what these people do. It's satire. You know, to suspend their account and call it hateful. Are we going to suspend all humor? Is that what? How about late night shows? You know, if they make fun of people all the time. How about talk radio? Do you ever hear some of the stuff that goes on? I mean, where do we draw the line? I don't see this promoting violence. I don't see this threatening. I don't see this, you know, coming against race or ethnicity or national origin or religious affiliation. You know, I don't get it. I really don't. I don't see the impetus behind this. But I just want to put that on your radar. It's one more of those stories that we are continuing to see. Hey, I do want to hit on another issue, too. A lot's going on today, especially in Oh, gosh, especially with the Supreme Court nominees. And I want to bring into the program today John Malcolm. It's good to have him join me today. He hails from the Heritage Foundation, and it's always a delight to tap into their expertise. I don't know if you've been following any of the Ketanji, Ketanji Brown Jackson hearings. I had a chance to watch some of those this morning, and they were quite telling, pushing her on everything from whether or not you're going to court pack to some of the decisions that she made. Hey, John, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
So, I mean, a lot going on, and I'll cut right to the heart of this. The Senate has enough votes to confirm her. What we're seeing today regarding her confirmation, is it just a formality? Because she's not really answering a whole lot of questions when it comes to court packing or some of these other issues that are being presented to her.
Well, it's a formality if all you're concerned about is whether she's going to be confirmed or not. I think it's highly likely she's going to be confirmed. All 50 Democratic senators are back in Washington. Senator Lujan has recovered. No Democratic senator has voted against any of the judicial nominees that the Biden White House has sent up to the Hill. And I sincerely doubt that any of the Democratic senators are going to vote against the first African-American woman nominated to the high court. So, all 50 Democrats are going to vote for her. And even if not a single Republican votes for her, then, Kamala Harris, acting in her role as president of the Senate, would cast a tie-breaking vote and she gets confirmed to the court. That doesn't mean that this is a formality, though. I think that the Republicans want to make a point of saying, look, things like judicial philosophy matters, and you should know that with a Democrat in the White House and a Democrat-controlled Senate, this is the kind of nominee that you get. But you get a very different kind of nominee if there is a Republican in the White House and a Republican-controlled Senate. The Senate is very much in play for this, the upcoming midterm elections, and the White House will be in play in 2024. So I think that they're making their points to a broader audience, but I don't think at the end of the day it is likely to doom Ketanji Brown Jackson's confirmation.
Give me your assessment on how you think she will affect the balance that's now in the court. There's a big Supreme Court case coming up, of course, that judges are evaluating now that will determine perhaps the future of Roe v. Wade. There's going to be a lot of other very critical cases in the not too distant future. How do you think that she'll affect the bench, if at all, or you think that it'll be the status quo, the same division of conservatives versus liberals, if you will?
Yeah, look, I think in the short term, there's likely not going to be much of a change. She's replacing the justice for whom she clerked, Justice Stephen Breyer, assuming she is confirmed. Using broad labels, you are replacing liberal with a liberal. So this is a little bit like Neil Gorsuch replacing, Antonin Scalia, and it is a far cry from Amy Coney Barrett replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But of course, these justices are on the bench for a very, very long time. And when Clarence Thomas was first named to the Supreme Court, he wrote a lot of soul dissents. And now he's viewed as probably the intellectual leader of the court, and he is getting to write and assign a lot more majority opinions. So the influence of a justice can change over time. But in the short term, it's not likely to have much of an impact. The case involving Roe versus Wade, the Dobbs case out of Mississippi, that's going to be decided this term.
So right, exactly.
Even if she's confirmed, she won't be on the bench. But there are important cases next term, including cases involving racial preferences in college admissions.
Yeah, I mean, she comes out, from what I've watched, to remain neutral, to have this neutral posture in a lot of the questions that she's given and the way that some of these questions have been thrown to her. I'd like to know your take on her personally. She's been a judge less than 10 years. She's going to be given a lifetime appointment here. What do you know of her, and what do we know of her character? What do we know of her judicial philosophy? We saw what Barrett went through when she was being nominated. We saw what Brett Kavanaugh went through. I love the fact that Cruz says, "Hey, we're not going to ask you whether you like beer or who you dated in high school or whatever." That I think it's very respectful, this exchange. But I do think, and I get frustrated because I think I'd like to know where you stand on some of these issues, like court packing. Are you open to it or you're not? Do you think it's a good idea or don't you? You are a judge. Something like this may come before you. But what do you make of her judicial philosophy and the length of time that she has been actually sitting on a bench?
Well, she's been a judge for 9 years. 8 of those years was as a district court judge. Most of the people who were on the Supreme Court, you know, don't have district court judge experience. The only exception to that is Sonia Sotomayor. You know, 9 years is a reasonably long time to be a judge. Elena Kagan was never a judge. Amy Coney Barrett was a judge on the Seventh Circuit for about a year and a half. But as a district court judge in D.C., you get a lot of administrative law cases. You get a fair number of statutory cases involving lawsuits against the government. She hasn't ruled on a whole bunch of constitutional issues. And, you know, she's largely ducked the question about what her judicial philosophy is. Although I will say, you know, today she did say, look, when I look at the Constitution, phrases in the Constitution, or I look at text, I try to understand how those words and phrases were understood by the people who drafted them at the time that either the statute was passed or the constitutional provision was ratified. That is a, you know, the kind of thing that one usually looks for in a conservative justice. Whether she's telling the truth or not, you know, remains to be seen. Sonia Sotomayor very much said that when she was nominated to the court, and I think she's deviated from that philosophy. I think that she's holding up reasonably well under all of these questions. Ted Cruz just finished asking questions in which he hit her pretty hard as being, you know, light on as a sentencer and in terms of her political, her policy beliefs about sex offenders. At one point he asked her a question. She really hesitated. You could tell she was biting her lip for a while before she answered.
Wow.
But she is holding up fairly well on the issue of court packing. She was asked about it, said, look, I know some people like Justice Thomas, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Breyer have said something about it. But so far as I'm concerned, it's not an issue that comes before the court. You, Congress, get to decide whether to expand the court or not. It's a policy issue. And you know what? I'm just not going to comment on policy issues. People may be satisfied with that answer or not, but that's her answer.
All right. Let me share just a quick clip or two with you. I love your comments on this. This is Ketanji on policing. Here's what she had to say about police. Big issue today.
As someone who has had family members on patrol and in the line of fire, I care deeply about public safety. I know what it's like to have loved ones who go off to protect and to serve, and the fear of not knowing whether or not they're going to come home again because of crime in the community. As you said, my brother patrolled the streets of Baltimore, and I had two uncles who were career law enforcement, including one who became the chief of police of the City of Miami Police Department in the 1990s. So crime and the effects on the community and the need for law enforcement, those are not abstract concepts or political slogans to me.
Your thoughts on that answer?
Well, she's had an interesting career. I mean, this is a woman who spent 2 years as an appellate lawyer for the Federal Defender Program. She also had a distant uncle, now deceased, who got involved in the drug trade and been sentenced to life in prison. He ended up having his sentence commuted by Barack Obama. But, you know, she's got a brother who was a police officer and two uncles who rose in the ranks as police officers. Similarly, you know, she represented Guantanamo terrorists, Guantanamo detainees, at the same time that she had a brother who was being deployed overseas. So she's got a lot of experience that are somewhat conflicting. I mean, she clearly cares about her family. So when she says, you know, when they went out and pledged to serve and protect, and you didn't know at the end of the day whether they were going to come home to their loved ones, that's very real. So I assume what she said was very heartfelt, but, you know, there's no question some of her positions as a sentencing commissioner and some of the sentences that she has imposed as a district court judge could be characterized as having been lenient on some very serious offenders.
Wonderful. Let me play one last clip for you. And I'm grateful for your time today. If you're tuned in, I'm speaking today with John Malcolm. Lindsey Graham addressed her a little bit earlier and drew a comparison to when Amy Coney Barrett sat in the same seat of scrutiny, and the difference right. in the tone taking place. But listen to this.
How would you feel if somebody up here on our side said, you know, you attend church too much for me, or your faith is a little bit different to me, and they would suggest that it would affect your decision? Would you find that offensive?
Senator, I'm...
I would if I were you. I found it offensive when they said it about Judge Barrett. The reason I ask these questions is I have no doubt that your faith is important to you, and I have zero doubt that you can adjudicate people's cases fairly if they're an atheist. If I had any doubt, I would say so. But the only reason I mention this, Judge, you're reluctant to talk about it because it's uncomfortable. Just imagine what would happen if people on late night television called you an effing nut, speaking in tongues because you've practiced the Catholic faith in a way they couldn't relate to or found uncomfortable. So, Judge, you should be proud of your faith. I am convinced that whatever faith you have and how often you go to church, it will not affect your ability to be fair. And I just hope going in the future that we all can accept that, and that Judge Barrett, I thought, was treated very, very poorly.
I think that's true. I liked what he had to say personally. I love your take on it.
Yeah, no, look, I think that is true. I think there's a certain hypocrisy that's going on here. He drew a sharp contrast to how Amy Coney Barrett was treated, both when she was nominated to the Supreme Court and when she was nominated to the Seventh Circuit. That's when Dianne Feinstein said, "The dogma lives loudly in you," and that, you know, that is a cause of concern for me. And you know, and everyone has said, "Oh, how overdue it is," and she's the first African American woman to be nominated to the court. The president said, "Long overdue."
Right.
Well, it was the president, when he was the Senate Judiciary Chairman, who tried to filibuster Janice Rogers Brown when she was nominated to the D.C. Circuit, and said, "You know, if she gets nominated to the Supreme Court," and she was widely viewed as a potential replacement for Sandra Day O'Connor, "it will be very, very, very," those are his words, "three very, very hard for her to get confirmed, and she will be filibustered." And had she not been filibustered, and had she, you know, not the filibuster not been robust at the time, Janice Rogers Brown might very well have been the first African-American woman on the Supreme Court. So there certainly is some hypocrisy going on here. The Republicans, I think, are right to point it out.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That is absolutely a fascinating bit of court history. I didn't know that. Hey, John, thank you. Thank you for your time. I'm grateful for it and for all that you do there. John Malcolm is Vice President of the Institute for Constitutional Government and the Director of the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. He's also a Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Check him out at heritage.org. Have a great one, John. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
When we return, we'll change gears, bring up the speed on the latest. Hunter Biden's laptop is real. There's been some news regarding this. I don't know if you follow the story or not. I think it's worth talking about. Stay with me.
Relevant Radio runs on horsepower, your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep your station running. Join in with thousands of other listeners who have given their unused vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
So good to be with you. It's an appropriate bumper, right? That's Don Henley. A little dirty laundry. Maggie is pretty clever. I got to credit Maggie, my producer and board op, for that one. We are talking, if you're just joining me right now, about a story that I know a lot of people have followed. I think it's well worth looking at, and that's of course Hunter Biden and his laptop. I was shocked. I really was taken back by the fact that, you know, nobody addressed this laptop issue during the last election. We just talked about Rachel Levine, right, and how the Babylon Bee, a satire site, got banned. They were put in Twitter jail for doing a piece calling her the man of the year. Rachel Levine is actually a man. It's not really a woman. We live in a time where if you articulate something that goes against the current philosophy of the culture or the mainstream media or big tech, your voice gets silenced. There's no exchange of thought. There's no dialogue or exchange. It's censorship. And then we see that. even to the point, to the extent of compromising, I believe, national security and the greater good, the citizenry of this country. I'm going to turn the hands of time back just for a minute. I'm going to go back to October, right? I want to go back to that October surprise. You know, it happens before any presidential election, piece of dirt comes out, right? And should derail that. If you follow presidential politics, you'll see that. And a couple of weeks just before Election Day, something comes up is meant to sway the election one way or the other. I remember when the, I'm thinking of the Hollywood, the video of Donald Trump supposedly in the trailer. Remember that before his 2016 election with Hillary Clinton? I'm just trying to think of the show that released that video. I can't remember. Access Hollywood. I think it was Access Hollywood video. I think it was what they had. That was the big October surprise, and Hillary knew that way ahead of time, released it. Didn't really derail Donald Trump. He actually won the election. But in this case, the Hunter Biden laptop story got totally muted. And I saw experts a couple days ago commenting on this, and they said, you know something, the independents that were out there, if this news would have come out, and there could be possible ties to Ukraine, to China, to some other areas, to Russia, perhaps it could have swayed things in another direction for the president. And those votes could have won certain states for him, and he could have been the president today. But remember what happened? The New York Post, the nation's fourth largest newspaper by circulation, they published the story about some emails from former Vice President Joe Biden's son, Hunter, now President Biden at the time, and apparently Hunter Biden arranged a meeting between his father, between Joe Biden and a Ukrainian businessman. And other emails showed that, you know, Ukrainians asked for help from Hunter to influence, you know, their country's affairs. And that was just the beginning. I mean, you can go through all this. There's a lot there. The New York Post put this out. They broke the story, and then Twitter blocked it. They blocked it. They just shut it down. They didn't want you, the American citizen, the voter, to know. And they blocked any number of accounts who posted on it. So, you know, here's your free speech. You want to say, oh, did you see this? Is this true? Is this fake? I can't believe this. Check this out. You're muted. You're silenced. You're censored. You're banned. They blocked accounts of people, including the White House spokeswoman at the time, which was Kayleigh McEnany, and even the president himself, who thought that the president would be censored. But that's the case. So now, the New York Times has recently come out and they have said, guess what? There's some truth to this. It's actually real. you know, don't you think that's important? When the story first broke, all of big tech, all these intelligence officials, all of the media, they didn't want anything to hurt their candidate. So they suppressed the story. They claimed, now let me just put this in perspective. They claimed it was a Russian plot. It was a Russian plot. Twitter issued warnings regarding the story. You know what PBS did? This is another irritating thing. This was terrible journalism. PBS wrote on Twitter, and this didn't get censored. They said, we don't want to waste our time on stories that are not real stories. They're not real. And we don't want to waste our listeners and our readers' time on stories that are pure distractions. Really? Did anybody check with the newspaper that release that story? Did anybody do their due diligence? Don't you think America, that the country deserve that, especially when they're going to go vote and the person that they put in office can radically transform the trajectory, the direction of this country? Don't you think we as a nation and as a people deserve at least the ability to dialogue and come to a deeper understanding of the truth? Throughout the 2020 campaign, Biden denied any knowledge of Hunter Biden's overseas businesses. And that's a bunch of BS, too, if you tell me. You know why? You're a father. I know what my kids are doing. I know what they're involved in. You know, maybe you don't see them a whole lot, right? Maybe Joe was busy. You know what your kid is doing, you know. And Biden went as far to say, oh, my son's laptop, that was a Russian plant. They love to blame everything on Russia, don't they? They love to do everything on that. So Paul Glatter is going to be joining me in just a moment. I always enjoy talking to him. He's got a great insight on this. I want to play for you a quick clip, though, just to give you some perspective. It's from the debate between President Trump and Biden when this issue came up. Listen to, well, a little bit of history here.
They have said that this has all the characteristics. Five former heads of the CIA, both parties, say what he's saying is a bunch of garbage.
This is classic Trump. We have 4 days left, and all of a sudden there's a laptop. There's overwhelming evidence that from the intelligence community that the Russians are engaged.
I still think that the stories from the fall about your son Hunter were Russian disengagement at a smear campaign, like you said.
Yes, yes, yes.
I know you'd ask it.
So, and there you go. I mean, it's a little bit of history for you. Let's talk about it, though. Now that the truth has actually come out, I've invited Paul Glatter, associate professor of journalism and media and entrepreneurship at the King's College in New York City. And he joins us today. It's always good to talk with him. He spent actually 10 years reporting for the Wall Street Journal. And it's one of my favorite publications. I think they do a phenomenal job. And I always appreciate his balanced and honest view. Paul, good to have you back. Good afternoon.
Great to be back with you, Drew.
So what do you make? I'd love your take on the evolution of this story. I mean, America wasn't allowed to discuss it, as we just pointed out. It had been banned. It was fake news. It was a waste of time. It was a Russian plant. And now all of a sudden, the New York Times, which was part of that, has come out and said, you know, there's a little bit more merit to this. There's evidence. You know, they got the hard drives. Does it make a difference now? Is it too late? Give me your take on the story, the evolution of it. And there's a lot to talk about, even what it says about the media and the exchange of thought that we have in our country. But let me start out with your thoughts.
Yeah, well, I mean, we haven't seen a full mea culpa from the New York Times or the social media companies that tried to basically shut down that story in October 2020. But as you mentioned, in a story in the last week about Hunter Biden's tax and foreign business affairs, they acknowledged that indeed the discarded laptop, there was merit to it, and acknowledged basically that it was indeed a story. So that's what we're all talking about. And, you know, I think that's the key thing to recognize. This, you know, what exactly happened, the postmortem, you know, that, as you mentioned, October surprises. I think one factor here was 2016, as you mentioned, there was an October surprise about Donald Trump's on-camera hot mic,
right,
talking about women with Billy Bush. And then there was a second one, though, which was the Comey investigation, FBI investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think part of the context here, Drew, is a lot of Democrats and people on the left felt that the FBI and Comey, by coming out with that in October, that lost the election for Hillary, won the election for Trump, and they, over their dead body, that, you know, some people did not want that to happen again. So when this laptop came out, as I was looking back on the New York Post story about this, Steve Bannon, it said, you know, had informed the Post in September about this laptop, and then they got a copy of it in October. So it indeed was an October surprise. Clearly, it has, you know, there's political skullduggery involved. Yes, mm-hmm. They're trying to, you know, make the other side look bad, but yeah, both sides do that. Mm-hmm. The question is, was it a story? And We can dissect that more, but I think resoundingly now, looking back, even the New York Times is admitting it was a story. They don't seem to be admitting they should have done the story at that time, but they're acknowledging that it was a story.
You know, as a journalist, as a professor, I'm going to take a short break. I want to come back. I want your take on where we are today. You know, when I was in school and I was taking journalism, I had a professor. He was an old salt, and he didn't like the evolution of news the way it was going, because it became very much opinion. You know, all this happy talk. He was old core. He liked the Walter Cronkite. He wants the news objectively. You never disclose your political affiliation. You report the facts, and that's it. And today, we see the landscape both of news, but we see another player. You see big tech now in this. You see social media and the way that can be manipulated. And we see the exchange of thought really, really in the crosshairs of that today. And I'd love your take on that. I want to talk a little bit about that more when we come back. If you want to join us, I only have my guest today, Professor Glatter, for a short time, but you can get in at 888-914-9149. We're taking a look at the latest with Hunter Biden's laptop, what it says about the media in general, and where we go from here. And, you know, I was sharing that the Babylon Bee got censored because of something they put up regarding Rachel Levine. We'll talk about all that and more. Stay with me. We'll be Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line.
For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Maybe we could get it back. With truth and honesty, that's what we need to hold on to the good stuff we believe in before we let go.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Good afternoon. Good to be back here with you today. We'll pray the Chapel to Divine Mercy coming up in about 10 minutes. If you're just getting plugged in, we're taking a look at the latest regarding Hunter Biden's laptop. You might say, hey, I thought that was an old story. Well, the New York Times has come out. They've done a partial mea culpa for it. And it raises questions about the implications that this holds for foreign policy. You know, the fact that this story was buried, ultimately censored. You weren't allowed to have access to it. Raises questions now that there is merit to it regarding the president's fitness for office, his ability to direct our foreign policy, particularly in a relationship to Ukraine and Russia, right? And much more. It really, I think it speaks to a bigger picture than even that. It speaks to the time in which we are currently living and the way information is transferred and censored and manipulated. And I'm all about truth. I want truth. I want to give it to you. And that's why I've invited Paul Glatter to join me, former Wall Street Journal journalist and longtime friend of this show. I'm always grateful to have him. He's an associate professor of journalism there at King's College as well. And here's my frustration, Paul. Maybe we can speak to this first. Journalism. I shared the story of my professor, Professor Parsons. I'll never forget him. Talking about journalism and what has happened to it, the evolution of it. Yeah, it's fun. It's, you know, you can listen to it. It's more lively. It's not as, you know, stiff maybe is the word to use. But I think we also lose something when you know, television news no longer reports objectively. And instead, they're biased in the way they report or the guests that they go to or in the context in which they deliver these types of stories. I know you come from an institution, the King's College in New York, where you're helping to form new journalists. Let's talk about two things. One, where are we heading? Because it's not just ABC, NBC, and CBS. It wasn't just your mainstream networks. We now have cable media. We now have social media. And this is the way people get their news in large part. We live in a very different time in how it's being delivered and how people receive it. If you could speak to that, and then maybe also what you're doing to make a difference in forming the future journalists of the world.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one thing here that we can lose sight of is basically the American ideals of journalism, you know, that really, I think, led to part and parcel to the exceptional, you know, 20th century in America, that we really pioneered in our journalism and journalistic ecosystem here pursuit of the facts, the idea that we should, as the New York Times used to have in one of its mottos, you should report the news impartially without fear or favor. And I think that's kind of our North Star, is to get back to the idea that it's important to follow the facts, that it's important to seek the truth, as you just noted. And I think I see it from the right and the left, that sometimes we want news and information to confirm our own biases. That's, you know, it's so called true confirmation bias. Yeah. And so can we live in a way where we are open to that we want to purchase media, vote with our pocketbooks, media that does report the truth, and that's very important in this instance. And and then, you know, beyond that, not accept the lack of doing that. So, I mean, what was sad about this situation, Jerry Baker, the former editor of the Wall Street Journal, who has a column now called Free Expression, he said the collaboration with big tech companies with some media outlets on that story about Hunter Biden's laptop, you know, was that they pulled off one of the greatest disappearing tricks since Harry Houdini made that elephant vanish from a New York stage. And I think that's the scary thing you allude to here, is if we're living in a world where there's a battle over information and the ability to surface information, you know, that's what's scary. If truth can be suppressed, because, you know, we pride ourselves on living in a country where it's not like, you know, Russia right now, where you can say things about Ukraine and justify a war that are, things that are completely false.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you there. I shared a story about Rachel Levine. I think it was USA Today or somebody nominated her as Woman of the Year. And Rachel Levine, of course, is a man, born a man, and is transgender. Yet Babylon Bee, which is a satirical site, I'm sure you're familiar with it, they got banned from Twitter for doing a piece calling Rachel Levine Man of the Year. What do you make of that?
I'm not as familiar with that particular case. I am familiar with Babylon Bee. And, you know, one thing I think is important here is that, Babylon Bee and other satire players like The Onion, right? They do potentially confuse people. And I'm not saying they needed to be banned or censored necessarily, but I do think citizens need help discerning what is true anymore, including what is satire. And I think satire often can and should be labeled. So I'm not sure if it applies to that particular situation. But I would say back on this Hunter Biden laptop thing, I mean, I can understand that sometimes media need time to verify a story. But I also think, you know, they had 2 weeks, it was 2 or 3 weeks before the election. Mm-hmm. And so suppressing it for 2 or 3 weeks and really doesn't look good. And taking a full however many, you know, almost 2 years now to
it was outright bias.
More than a year.
I've not being partisan, trying to be journalistic. It was bad journalism, and it was overt bias from big tech and from the mainstream media. You watch any of the news broadcasts, whether it's PBS or CNN or MSNBC or ABC, NBC. You go through the litany of them. Everybody censored it. They buried the story. They didn't talk about it. They made excuses for it. They're pundits. And that's just a disservice to the country and to its citizenry. You know, let's just get to the truth, whether we like it or not. We're going to be stronger and better for it. Hey, I only have a minute left. I want to make sure I put a plug in for King's College before we wrap it up here, because that's a great institution. And I know you're doing wonderful work, as I said, to form the next generation of journalists. Do you want to share with everyone what you're doing?
Yeah, basically, we've got a really excellent high-performing journalism major and program at King's, and the students are winning lots of national awards, getting great jobs at many of the outlets, from the New York Post to Wall Street Journal to CNBC and tons of Fortune Magazine, tons of places in between. So we're trying to, to live that ideal of teaching people how to pursue the truth with impartiality. And to dig as reporters. And so, if you know young people who should apply and come, please tell them to do so. We have a 4-year major, and we also have a summer academy for a week if you have students, high school students, who want to come to study with us for a week in July.
Well, we need good journalists, that's for sure. Well-formed journalist. I often think about my journalism professor, and I'm so grateful for the values that he instilled in me. But, Paul, thank you for making time for us today. Keep up your good work, okay?
Thank you, Drew.
Always good to have you. That's Professor Paul Glatter. I've got about a minute to go. I want to put this on your radar as well. We're going to be, of course, this Friday, praying or giving you live coverage at 11 Central Time of Pope Francis's consecration of Russia and Ukraine to the world. We'll take that feed live. I'll give you some commentary. I'll be anchoring that along with Father Rocky. Right after we're done praying the chaplet this afternoon, I want to make you aware of this. They have released early the consecration prayer. And there's a couple of things that are important to look at. There have been 4 different consecrations. You know, the 84 one was accepted by heaven. But words are powerful. They have meaning. Is it an entrustment? Is it a consecration? I read through it. The word consecration is in there. We'll take you through it. I'm going to break it down for you, tell you why all this is significant. And in the spiritual dynamic, why it matters and what the fruit of this might be. That's coming up right after we pray the chapel. You'll be one of the first to hear what that prayer is going to be. And hopefully you'll join us Friday as we're part of, I think, a spiritually historic moment for the church and for the world. I'm Drew Mariani. I'll be back with more right after this.